This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm very happy to be here. I would like to show how Rousseau's autobiographical works base a series of practices of freedom on an unexpected foundation, that of idleness. My examples will be drawn mainly from two representative works, Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, and The Reveries of a Solitary Walker. In contrast to Rousseau's political writings, where freedom is defined in relation to work as a condition of the citizen's political emancipation, Rousseau's autobiographical period sees a virtual about-face when he develops his, what he calls his grand project of idleness. Rousseau, as you probably know, has a very ambivalent relationship with idleness, and I will speak about that. This reorientation is neatly summed up in a statement from his Considérations sur le gouvernement de Pologne, Considerations on the Government of Poland, where Rousseau writes, "Repose and freedom appear incompatible to me. It is necessary to choose." But, as we shall see, doing nothing will become the formula for the solitary experience of freedom. Rousseau seeks to remove himself from various forms of constraint or subjugation. He chooses disengagement and disinterest. It is as if the thinker of the social contract later came to invent a logic of subjective freedom that is unconstrained by any bond or attachment, in fact, a new sovereignty of liberty. Laziness is the organizing principle of Rousseau's entire moral persona. He seeks to withdraw from the universe of action. This is what impels him to give into a series of pursuits that could be described as invisible. For example, that of music, which Rousseau tells us is suited to his lazy mind. He adjusts easily to his middling financial condition, neither luxury nor deprivation. His intellectual work is measured by the same yardstick of moderation. He must avoid the fatigue of thought, especially when it is linked to the obligation to produce books. Thought must be free, not ruled by necessity. He writes, "If I sometimes like to think, it is freely and without constraint, letting my ideas flow at will without subjecting them to anything. But thinking of this or of that as an obligation, as a trade, making my productions correct, methodical, is for me the work of a galley slave." Rousseau thus withholds his output from the market, applying the label book factory, livrier in French, to the writer who produces books for money, who is incapable of the detachment required by the products of the soul. Rousseau's words. The livrier also resembles the hyperactive scientist that Rousseau describes at work in the laboratory. Both suffer from the itch to talk or to produce results. Laziness, as a withdrawal from the world of will, installs Rousseau in a constellation of marginal figures. He joins, for example, those whose stance of philosophical indigence entails an acceptance of circumstances, a refusal of capitalist accumulation. Laziness becomes the laziness of desire, an apathy with regard to objects. Rousseau finds an interesting way to convey Jean-Jacques' attitude, and that is in Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques. "Another prop," he writes, "for his laziness," that is Jean-Jacques, "in any affair that was a little lengthy was the uncertainty time places on successes which seemed the most assured in the future. 1,000 unforeseen events being capable of aborting the best conceived plan at any moment." Laziness, we see, is a friend of circumstance. It falls in step with probabilities. Jean-Jacques chooses to live from day to day. But the most radical forms of inactivity for Rousseau remain the reverie and the promenade. The reverie, the intellectual suspension of will, is the most highly valued state of the lazy mind. Reverie makes it possible to set aside the body, to cancel it out in favor of imagination. It is the entryway to the contemplative life. Reverie is the opposite, the disgusted opposite of action, a sort of antimatter. In Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, we find this interesting consequence of reverie, the peculiar passivity of the subject, a singular dispossession of will. And Rousseau writes that, quote, one enjoys without acting. On jouit sans rien faire, which is bizarre. But I believe you may imagine what Rousseau is thinking about here. As for the promenade, it incorporates the restless side of laziness, but still produces nothing. The promenade asks nothing of the will. It merely accompanies the subject, tracing his freely wandering paths. And I quote, he will always repeat the same walk until some motive absolutely forces him to change. His feet carry him back by themselves to where they have already carried him. He likes to walk straight ahead always because that can be done without his needing to think about it. End of quote. Laziness participates in an involuntary reflex of mobility. One text in particular epitomizes this double figure of idleness, the reveries of the solitary walker. Written late in Rousseau's life, 1772 to 1778, the reveries offer an interesting perspective on the deliberate intention to produce, above all, an other body, liberated from all constraints, existing apart from any relation of knowledge or power. In fact, the reveries reproduce, though in an inverted form, the entire technology of control over the subject. Rousseau's autobiographical project in Rêverie must be understood directly as an enterprise of aerated individualization, which is apolitical in the sense of being disengaged from the various sites of power and all forms of relation. This is what Rousseau calls his désœuvrement, which would become Blanchot's maître mot, you know, worklessness. An attempt to disengage the body, to air out its materiality, rather, to objectively nullify his person. Rousseau proposes the reverie as an examination. But here, the gesture of observation is strictly interiorized. It takes the form of a self-surveillance, but that is disoriented, utterly without constraint, a meditation that dispenses with any results, any science of the self. Here, self-examination becomes a volatile, unproductive operation. Right off the bat, Rousseau eliminates order and method. And I see this quote, I quote this citation. I am incapable, Rousseau writes, of such work, and it would even take me away from my goal, which is to make myself aware of the modifications of my soul and of their sequence. I will perform on myself, to a certain extent, the measurements natural scientists perform on the air in order to know its daily condition. I will apply the barometer to my soul, and these measurements, carefully executed and repeated over a long period of time, may furnish me results as certain as theirs. But I do not extend my enterprise that far. I will be content to keep a record of the measurements without seeking to reduce them to a system. The fifth promenade in the Rêverie is perhaps the best illustration of this new state for Jean-Jacques. Here we find the clearest expression of what becomes the unproductive subject, what may have been seen as the gestation of the autonomous subject, the Kantian meaning, can be understood here as the complexly constructed asceticism of the individual freed from the constraints of time. Rousseau's promenade abandons calculated time for the open schedule, the irregularity of whim, the individual idiosyncratic pursuits. The state he desires is one in which, he says, time is nothing, and the present lasts forever without, however, making its duration noticed and without any trace of time's passage. Rousseau, thus, reports the happiness of his delightful retreat to the island of Saint-Pierre. He writes, "The precious far niente was the first and the principal enjoyment I wanted to savor in all its sweetness. And all I did during my sojourn, I cannot pronounce this word in English, I'm sorry, was in effect only the delightful and necessary pursuit of a man who has devoted himself to idleness." This moment in the rêverie, which achieves a new conceptualization of time, can be juxtaposed to a key episode in the dialogue, the Rousseau Judge of Jean-Jacques, a fundamental part of the reform project in which Rousseau relates how Jean-Jacques emancipates himself from his watch. "The moment," Rousseau writes, "when he got rid of his watch, renouncing all thought of becoming rich in order to live from day to day, was one of the sweetest days of his life. Heaven be praised," he cried in a fit of joy, "I won't need to know what time it is any longer." Jean-Jacques frees himself from the discipline of the clock to enter into a personal, interiorized time without rule or constraint, an idiosyncratic time of which he is the sole master, in which he can lose track of time. He bids good riddance to mechanically regulated time, divest himself of any timetable. Detaching himself from the Genevan instrument of measurement par excellence, also a symbol of growing industrialization, is perhaps the most anti-Calvinist gesture in Rousseau's body of work. I'm skipping something because I'm afraid to be too long here. Idleness, as the effacement of the exterior, makes it possible to nourish the interior life of psychic activity alone. And even the latter is subject to a minimum of constraints. Reasoning is abandoned, unmediated affect or affective reminiscence rules. In the end, even the activity of writing becomes doomed to inactivity. The notation of the reverie or of the promenade, through the avoidance of any stricture, obeys the order of the far niente, of absolute amusement, that is, of occupation as a waste of time. Thus, we may understand that the reverie are from the outset doomed to incompletion. Rousseau dies before finishing them. Later, Rousseau proposes in the rêverie botany as the solitary worker's ideal activity. Botany, he writes, is a study for an idle and lazy solitary person. He adds, "In this idle occupation, there is a charm we feel only in the complete calm of the passions." Just what is it about botany? If this activity enjoys Rousseau's approval, it is because he conceives of it as fundamentally disinterested, barely requiring the investment of the body. Botany harmonizes with the luxurious idleness desired by the subject. If botany is still a form of work, it is, as Rousseau says, not a toilsome work, his words, but one of amusement, fun, The same promenade that is for Rousseau the botanist's sole task is also a form of recreation. The freely wandering gaze that observes without concern for profit or instruction. In the Rêverie, Jean-Jacques eliminated other activities because they could impose constraints, yoking the organism extensively to activity. He thus renounces knowledge meant for practical applications. Botany, for Rousseau, has the advantage of existing apart from any utilitarian hierarchy of techniques. Rousseau reaches his decision through a kind of negative deduction. Thus, he starts by rejecting mineralogy for its deleterious demands. To make progress, he writes, in the study of minerals, it is necessary to be a chemist or a physicist. It is necessary to perform tedious and costly experiments, to work in laboratories, to spend much money and time in the midst of charcoal, crucibles, furnaces, retorts, smoke, and suffocating fumes, always at the risk of life and often at the expense of health. The study of the animal kingdom elicits in the Rêverie similar reproaches. He writes, how am I to observe, dissect, study, become acquainted with the birds in the air, the fish in the water, or the quadrupeds swifter than the wind and stronger than men, which are no more disposed to come offer themselves to my research than I to run after them to make them submit to it by force. Therefore, inverting such pursuits, botany makes no demands on the body, and it is not affected by any instrumentality. The botanist's tools require no codification of the body. Rousseau writes, a point and a magnifying glass are all the apparatus that he needs. They are, that point and the glass. In other words, a non-binding extension of the organ that they supplement, in this case, the eye and the hand. Perhaps the blacksmith embodies for Rousseau the most abject image of the laborer. He participates in artificial and excessive forms of industry in the single-minded, circuitous, nocturnal pursuit of natural riches. Even more opposed to the blacksmith than the botanist is the shepherd, who in a sense, for Rousseau, is the redeemed worker. Rousseau sees farm work as bathed in the glow of sunlight, as absorbed in the contemplation of nature's gifts. In fact, Rousseau even suggests the shepherd does not work. He is the immediate recipient of the natural objects that are placed within reach. I now turn to one of the most surprising moments in the Rêverie. In the seventh promenade, the solitary botanizing excursion that brings Rousseau to the doors of a stocking mill, Manufacture de Bas. True, this episode can be read as the unconscious reactivation of Rousseau's paranoia as he re-encounters within his idyllic place of isolation and refuge the human contacts he had fled, his infamous persecutors. Rousseau's botanical reverie is interrupted, he tells us, by a certain clanking that, he says, was repeated and increased. In fact, the rhythmic noise of the factory, the cadence of work, of the machine itself. Here, extreme singularity is brought up short by the anonymous mechanical apparatus of human industry, Rousseau will write later. I got up, he says, burst through a thicket of brush on the side from which the noise was coming, and in a little hollow, 20 feet from the very place where I believed myself to have been the first to arrive, I saw a stocking mill. Rousseau is repelled by such agitation, which goes against the grain of the true philosophical attitude of exquisite repose. A distinction made by Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition may shed light on this passage of the Rêverie. Arendt emphasizes the new rhythm brought to bear by the industrial machine. The distinction that she makes is between labor and work, which is a wonderful distinction that she makes in The Human Condition. The machine is thus distinguished from the tools of Homo Faber, work, which used to involve individual separate gestures, becomes labor as the machine imposes a collective, rhythmically ordered performance, Arendt writes. Arendt develops this crucial notion. It is, she says, the machine's movement which enforces the movements of the body. The point is that nothing can be mechanized more easily and less artificially than the rhythm of the labor process. That is also in The Human Condition. In the end, the alienation of Homo Faber from his tools and the substitution of the machine result in the disappearance of the rhythm of the human body. In La Rêverie du Promeneur Solitaire, Rousseau presents for our contemplation an ascetic construction of the self that escapes from the model of constraint. What must be heard in this project of retreat, as he envisions it in his final days, are his tedious cries for liberty. If this text is intended as a protest against the Enlightenment and its philosophe, Rousseau's critique lays claim to a languidly heroic freedom. "I could not bear subjection," he writes. "I was perfectly free, and better than free, for bound only by my affections, I did only what I wanted to do. Shunning any and every obligation, the subject renounces all activity. He avoids doing at all cost. I know," he writes, "that the only good which might henceforth be within my power is to abstain from doing." Here, Rousseau opposes himself to others who are compulsively busy, always restless. Between inaction and will, he achieves a paradoxical critical reconciliation, the foundation of a new conduct, an ontological attitude, an ethics of freedom. He says, "I no longer have any other rule of conduct than in everything to follow my own propensity without restraint." More precisely, the scandal of Rousseau's version of freedom, indeed, this is how he perceives the radical nature of his approach, must be understood according to a doubly negated restriction adopted by the subject: never to do what one does not want to do. Deleuze would see this formulation of Rousseauist freedom as fitting squarely within the logic of negative preference he speaks of in commenting Bartleby. The grammar of Rousseau's phrase indeed emphasizes the singular situation of the solitary subject. It imposes his reactive but absolute selectivity with respect to all forms of action. Rousseau makes laziness the very motor of lack of will, of willlessness. This inertia is governed above all by the relation to the self, as he explains in Rousseau's Judge of Jean-Jacques. Rebellious to any other will, he does not even know how to obey his own, or rather, he finds it so tiring even to will that he prefers in the course of living to follow a purely mechanical impression that carries him along without his having to direct it. Moreover, the laziness of will becomes Rousseau's explanatory term for all other negations of activity. It must be aligned with, also in Rousseau's Judge of Jean-Jacques, laziness about thinking and laziness to talk. However, and I will conclude finally, it is clear that Rousseau's Vita Otiosa achieves transfiguration only at the price of renouncing history, renouncing even life itself in the impatient quest for disappearance. The desire for an infinite suspension of time results in frozen time. The creation of the subject, his epiphany, coincides with death in the ultimate retreat. In the end, the creature's laziness coincides with the subject's final blackout.